Let me introduce myself. My name is Steve Childers. I'm church planter in the northern Dallas suburb of Plano, Texas. And I kidded about that frequently, so you can join right in the process through the rest of the seminar or the rest of the conference that we have. I am in the midst of my second church planting experience. My first one was in Oklahoma City in 1977. So this is round two. I'm told you're supposed to make all your mistakes on the first church planting experience. Maybe all your mistakes on the first and second. I don't know yet. We're in the process of finding out. Now, I was put on the spot recently at a missions conference in the North Texas Presbytery. I was sitting there calmly enjoying the program and not avoiding slipping into the second and third stages of anesthesia. And all of a sudden, the man behind the podium had a brilliant idea, and he said, "What we'll do is we're going to ask each of our church planters who are with us here today to come, and we'd like to kind of put you on the spot so our people can get to know you a little bit better." You know, the joy that just filled my soul when he said that. And he said, "But I'll tell you in advance the three questions that we want you to answer when you come up here. I'll give you just a moment to think about your answers to those questions. The first question is, what is your favorite ice cream?" And so immediately I knew that that would not throw me, that there was no problem there, because coffee Häagen-Dazs is everyone's favorite ice cream. Number two, what is the thing that you like most about the state of Texas? Immediately that was no problem, because I had just lived the previous winter in Chicago, and Chicago in that winter had set an all-time record low of a wind chill factor of 80 below. And it was immediately known to me that that response would be the nice, dry, warm weather in Texas. And then the third question, tell us the most exciting thing that's happened in your church planting context over the last several months that you've been on the field. Immediately, I knew the answer to that one, too. That was probably easier than the ice cream or the state of Texas question. Now, as you well know, you're expected at that time as a church planter to come forward and to give that exciting news, which is supposed to key in on nickels and noses, the idea of how you've done financially on the financial chart, or how that attendance chart has climbed up into the upper stories. And that is what you're supposed to report on. But my wife knew immediately, as I knew, what I was going to share. In fact, she looked over at me at the same time, you know, and our heads just turned like this and looked toward each other, and we both said in a whisper, "The men's discipleship group." And you see, God has raised up a group of highly committed men in the Dallas area who have a real vision for Trinity Presbyterian Church, and I thank Him for that. I'm just, and I say this sincerely, not with a false humility, but I am truly one member of a team of men who are seeking to establish a work in the northern Dallas area. In the next few moments, what I'd like to do is share with you some of the dynamics behind the idea of the development of a ministry team. Now, to be upfront with you, I do not see or perceive myself as being an expert in the area of developing a team. I'm convinced that many of you here, if not most of you, have had equal or greater experience. But what I would like to do, I would like to share with you some of the essential things that I have learned over this process in developing a team, to the end that you might be motivated in your present process and that you might in some way be better equipped as you return to the field. So what I'd like to do is have you take your lecture notes. What we're going to do is begin by looking at the foundation, which we'll call the need for developing a team. Four reasons why you should spend that precious commodity of your time and of your energy, which is so scarce in church planting situations, in the pouring of your life into the development of a team of men. Okay, let's look at each one of these. The first reason, listed as A on your outline, is that it enables the work of the ministry to be shared by others. You see, there's a serious problem plaguing the church today. I call it the Plan B mentality. The Plan B mentality says, let clerical George do it. And it's built on three erroneous ideas. Now, don't try to write these down because I'm going to go through them rapid fire. Just get the general thrust of what is a Plan B mentality. These three erroneous ideas is probably the most common philosophy of the average church member in our churches today. Number one, the real work of the ministry is done by pastors. Number two, the main role of the laity is to support the pastor so that he can do the work of the ministry. And number three, the main role of the pastor is to personally minister to the needs, to all the needs of the flock. Now, although this may sound good, the results can be devastating, as you well know. The laity can become spiritually stagnant, extremely frustrated on the sidelines. And not only that, but the pastor relinquishes his high calling as an equipper of men and becomes often literally consumed with such tasks as folding bulletins, typing bulletins, mowing lawns, and stacking chairs. And it's a serious issue that we face today. Christian educator Howard Hendricks compares this type of what we're calling here a Plan B mentality adopted in churches to the Dallas Cowboy football team. And Hendricks says it's like a Dallas Cowboy professional football game in Big D. You just got a few men who are out on the field in desperate need of rest. And you have 75,000 people on the sidelines and in the stands in desperate need of exercise. And you see, it's a mentality that permeates our churches in the Presbyterian Church in America and in most all evangelical churches, and it's devastating. It's a dangerous mentality, not only to the laity, not only to the ministry, but to the pastor himself. God's plan is what we'll call the Plan A mentality, found and beautifully set forth in Ephesians chapter 4. Here we have, in a sense, in a nutshell, three biblical truths that are antithetical to Plan B. They're the exact contradiction, they're the exact opposite. A Plan A mentality builds upon these three biblical truths. Number one, the idea that the real work of the ministry belongs to the laity and not to the pastor. Number two, that the main role of the pastor is to equip people for ministry, not to merely minister. And three, the main role of the laity is to do the work of the ministry, not to merely support the pastor's work. Now, as I share these things, I was even hesitant to share this because it is so common. Most pastors, in fact, I would say almost all pastors and all church planters know this truth intellectually. If we don't learn it before, then when we're at the Holy Seminary, it's at that point that we learn this truth. But yet, in reality, I think we have to admit, if we're going to be honest, the bottom line, we deny it. Although we may know it intellectually, we most often deny it practically when we're actually on the field and functioning in ministry. But when this plan is understood, and when this plan is not only just understood in the realm of theory, which I would say almost every one of us would understand it and accept it and believe it, but when it is understood and then when it is followed in the context of ministry, then the pastor is freed up to fulfill his high calling as an equipper of men, the way God means him to be. And it's then, as Frank Tillipaw says, it's then that the church is literally unleashed in the ministry so that it becomes a shared ministry, the way that God has always planned it to be in the Plan A. So the second reason, that's the first reason, it enables the work of the ministry to be shared by others. That's why you should invest your time and energy into developing a team. The second reason, it creates a support base for the leadership of a church. Another common problem most pastors and church planters face is the lack of strong personal support. A strong personal support base for the local church planter or for the local church pastor is seldom found. Most pastors have a lone ranger mentality, and few can even be found with a tonto. It's kind of that we're on our own, and in the midst of need, and when the fire is up, there's no place to turn. And some of us would say, well, we turn to our wives, but often we turn to our wives and we see they're burning up right in the midst of the same fire that we're in. It's so common for men not to have a support base. The result is when the fire does get turned up, there's no place to turn for support, and we experience that common term used a lot in our circles today, and that's ministry burnout. A developing team can play a major role in helping to prevent this, not only for the pastor, but I say this also for the lay leaders. If anyone is subject to burnout, it's that first crew of people who dare to work with you during those initial months. They are subject to burnout in their spiritual lives, in their family, in their work, as subject as you are. And there's a desperate need for a support base, not only for them, but also for you. This last week, some circumstances came up, and I had to call off the men's discipleship group meeting. And so I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll just call these people and tell them that we can't meet tonight. And so I called this one man who's an executive in Northern Dallas, and his wife answered the phone. And I said, listen, the discipleship group is not going to be able to meet tonight. Tell Mark that this is his assignment. She said, okay. She's rated it right. And I said, tell him that he's to be a number one kind of family man tonight. That he's to give himself to the family and be a model family man. And I expected her to say, great, wow, what an assignment. And she was pleased. But her response was extremely interesting. She said, you know, that is great, Steve, and we desperately need it, and I'm very pleased. But I'll tell you something, Mark is going to be very disappointed. I said, disappointed? And she said, yes. She said, you don't know how in the midst of the corporate struggles and the corporate battles that he faces day in and day out, how that men's discipleship group is a lifeline for him. It gets his feet back down. It keeps him in touch with what are the right priorities, the right goals. It pulls him out of the slush pit and puts him back into the reality of the things of God and the kingdom of Christ. And he lives for that time. I didn't know that. And it's a support base for him. And not only for him, but I can tell you the times where I've been most discouraged and not wanting to turn to my wife and dump on her and tell her all my latest problems so she can just mound up more. It has been a very special and precious time to have these men where I can go and I can be me and I can be vulnerable and I can say, here's where I'm hurting, and these men will stop it all, walk around, pray for me, and be a support base for me. We need that. We desperately need that. And so do the men in our core group. Number three, the third reason we should invest our time and energy in developing a team is because it lays a strong foundation for a future ministry of multiplication. It lays a strong foundation for a future ministry of multiplication. In 2 Timothy 2:2, we have that vision of equipping faithful men who will in turn reproduce their lives and the lives of others. This vision, which is so prominent in parachurch circles like Navigators and Crusade and the rest, is a biblical vision and a vision that is to be shared by the Church of Jesus Christ. But it's a sad thing that this vision of pouring your life into the lives of others who will in turn become reproducers can be lost in the midst of giving ourselves to the programs, the necessary, and I say that carefully, the necessary programs and ministries of the church. The programs and the ministries of the church can so consume us that we lose sight of that goal or that vision of being an equipper of men who are in turn going to be spiritual reproducers. You see, people, and I say this as one who has walked and is seeking to no longer walk this road, people can easily become nothing more than the necessary ingredients in our program to make it work. It's kind of like, and they'll catch on. I mean, I've had some people really catch on. That, you know, you don't care about me. What you care about is this program. It's this goal. It's this objective. And all I am is a little peg in the puzzle. And all you're going to do is take me and put me in this master plan. And I'm just like another number. I'm not a person. And it's a deadly thing that can happen. And we can fall into that trap. We can lose that whole vision of people and sacrifice it to the cause of necessary programs and ministry. Our steering committees or our sessions can easily become almost completely administrative in nature. The idea that our business meetings become just that. They become corporate business meetings that we sprinkle with prayer and spiritual words. And it's the idea that our meetings really are, we come and we'll open in prayer and then we'll be about business like some kind of a corporate board and we'll use some spiritual words and we'll dismiss in prayer. But there's a loss there of this concept of building into the lives of one another and recognizing that key concept of the vision of 2 Timothy 2:2. Robert Coleman, an old seminary professor of mine who instilled and fueled a lot of this to me, said this. The quote is in your lecture notes. Follow with me. He said, when his, meaning Jesus' plan, is reflected upon, the basic philosophy is so different from that of the modern church that its implications are nothing less than revolutionary. His concern was not with programs to reach the multitudes, but with men whom the multitudes would follow. Men were to be his method of winning the world to God. The initial objective of Jesus' plan was to enlist men who could bear witness to his life and carry on his work after he returned to the Father. You see, it is my contention that to be Christ-like in our ministries means that we must prioritize the investing of our lives in the lives of those who will bear the maximum responsibility for the future ministry of the church. Then, and I believe only then, do we really lay a solid foundation for future ministry that will multiply in generations to come after you and I have well passed from the scene. Okay, then the final reason on the next page of the lecture notes that we should be assuming our role as an equipper of men is because it establishes a structure for maximum church growth. Church growth studies have shown, as most of you well know, that pastors who, and here again I emphasize the difference between the cognitive grasping of this concept and the actual implementation or application of it. Those pastors who, number one, share this philosophy of ministry, intellectually they understand it and they grasp it, but number two, they actually function as equippers of men rather than, as Wagner would put here, doers. This increases the church's potential for growth, according to the recent church growth study. This diagram is taken from Pete Wagner's book, Leading Your Church to Growth, where he expounds on this in much greater detail. It's a great book in seeking to amplify on some of these concepts. Okay, this is kind of the rationale for why this is important and some of the reasons why developing a team is to be a crucial part of the local church ministry, whether it's local church planting or beyond. What then are the dynamics of developing a team? One of the best models, obviously, is in developing a team is the model of Christ in the training of the 12. Now, in the Master Plan of Evangelism, Robert Coleman sets forth 8 dynamics that can be seen in the Master's Plan. Let's take a brief look at each of these just to kind of to get our appetites a little bit wet here. And then I hope that we can move through this fast enough and get into some real practical detail and maybe have some time for some questions and answers if there are any. But let's just go through this process of the model of Christ and seeking to follow and learn from the model of Christ in the development of a team right here where we are in 20th century suburbia or wherever we're planted. Okay, the idea, first of all, is the dynamic of what Coleman calls selection. Selection. Men were his method. The idea here is that just as Jesus took very seriously the selection of the 12, so must we if we're going to really build a team. Now, what this means is a couple things I'd like to amplify here. Number one, when selecting team members, we must aim at those who have a genuine heart to grow in Christ. We must selectively choose those people who we, especially at the very, very early stages, I'll talk about how it has changed. We're now in our 4th discipleship group, moving toward officer training. But especially during the initial group, we need to always be very, very conscious of the importance of targeting and selecting those who prove themselves as having a genuine, sincere desire to grow in Christ. My policy has proven true. I don't even remember where I learned it, first of all. But the policy has proven true over and over and over again in the last years where I've been involved in disciple making. Only select and challenge fat people. They challenge fat people. They are the only ones who will really stick with you. And the idea there is fat is the acrostic, as many of you know. F is faithful. A is people who are available. I tell you, there are some people who are so caught up in their work and responsibility, they're just not available. So they need to be people who are faithful, people who will do what they say they'll do and show themselves faithful, people who are available, and people who are teachable. People who are teachable. People who are faithful, available, and teachable. And when we find these kind of people, we must challenge them, as did the Lord, with the high cost of discipleship. And I can't emphasize that enough. The high cost of discipleship, setting forth high requirements to be involved in the discipleship group. Upon arrival in Plano, one of my first objectives, I set aside the first 4 weeks after we landed in Plano to begin to pray and to begin to look for faithful, available, and teachable men, asking God to raise up even just one or two men who would be faithful, available, and teachable that I could challenge after a 4-week period. That was one of my initial strategies, to pray that God would raise up faithful, available, and teachable men. After 4 weeks, I challenged several men, and we began the first men's discipleship group. Selection. The next dynamic, association. He stayed with them. Just as the Lord was intimately involved in the lives of his men, so must we if we're going to really develop a team. You know what this means? To be very practical, we must learn to spend time with them, and here's the clincher, apart from normal church function. This means we must learn to spend time with them. We must have periodic lunches with them. Invite the man and his wife over for dinner. Take them to Presbytery. Now, I don't know about you, but that's not a normal church function in my area. And you can go to Presbytery. And Presbytery, three or four times a year, however often you meet, it is an excellent opportunity to take the man with you. I know it's not very hospitable, maybe not to meet in the homes of the people that are the host church, but get a motel room and go to Presbytery and spend a day or two laughing, having a good time, going out to eat together, and going to Presbytery. It's a great opportunity that's apart from the norm where you can spend personal time with these men. I had one man that for a long time, this last year, was meeting with me every morning at 6:15 a.m. When we would exercise together. And he would come purposefully prepared with questions almost every morning. And you know what it's like at 6:15 in the morning to be starting this power walk, and this guy comes up with a question on the incarnation of Christ, and I'm not even awake. That's the way heresies get started, I'm sure. But the idea is, we're not in the discipleship group meeting. We're not in Sunday school. We're not at the church. It's a way of life kind of an idea. And we're apart from the normal church functions. Here we must learn also to show genuine concern for each person, not merely for their program or for their ministry or for the kind of output we're going to get out of them if we invest in them. A genuine, sincere concern for them. Learn to ask questions. Ask questions about what are their dreams, what are their needs. Learn to listen to them. Find out their greatest temptations and struggles. With every man in business in the marketplace, I believe we as pastors and church planters ought to be tuned in to say, what are your greatest struggles? What are your greatest temptations to compromise in your business? What are your greatest struggles that you face day in and day out? We ought to be tuned in to those kind of things. It's amazing the needs that they have that they'll never let out unless you probe, learn to ask questions, and learn to listen. Then I think after you do that, the other principle under association, learn to accept them and learn to believe in them. With all their spiritual warts, learn to accept them and believe in them. Never forget that Jesus had his Peter, that Jesus had the sons of thunder who wanted to burn up things, that Jesus had his Thomas. Learn to accept them. Learn to believe in them. I blew that so much in my first church and first church planting situation. I took a man who was like an Apostle Peter. He was gruff. He was kind of crude. And I didn't believe in him. In fact, it was always animosity. It was always tension. He needed somebody to believe in him, somebody to trust in him. And we must do that same thing. Association. Next dynamic, consecration. Consecration. It required obedience. Jesus sought to create in his disciples a lifestyle of consecrated obedience. Many things we could talk about here. But one that comes to my mind as being crucial in our role and what we can do, one of the most important ways that we can set these people apart and consecrate them to a lifestyle of obedience is, number one, I believe, to pray for them. To pray for them and to take that seriously. As you associate with these men, you will learn their deepest needs. When they share with you what happens in that marketplace, when they share with you as they travel and they're in those motels where nobody sees them or those hotels where nobody's around, and the temptations that come their way, and you know that he's on a business trip, what's your responsibility before God for that man? Pray for them. Pray for those needs that you've tuned yourself into. This is a time where they know nothing about what you're doing. There's no glory here. It's you in the prayer closet, consistently, never letting a minimum of a week go by that you don't take that person individually before God and lift his needs to the Father. It's a key aspect in building a team. Without it, it can't happen. Not only pray for them, but pray with them. Individually pray with them whenever the opportunity comes. A man will come by frequently. One of the men will come by my office, and there'll be some kind of a need. We'll have a great time of praying together. Pray with them as a group. We have a priority that when we meet as a discipleship group, at least a minimum of 30 minutes, it's usually an hour, is spent in our discipleship group in nothing but prayer. And to the Koreans, they say, well, you just got started, huh? Yeah. But the idea is we spend a minimum of 30 minutes, usually an hour in prayer together as a team. It's a crucial part of the development process. Consecration. Next page. Impartation. He gave himself away. He gave himself away. In seeking to build a team, our Lord gave himself to his disciples by imparting to them spiritual truth. I had a conversation with Archie Parrish about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and in it he shared with me a powerful old truth that he has, in a sense, rediscovered recently in the development of some of his evangelism programs, and that is the evangelism programs won't fly, no matter how hard we push them, if we have people whose lives are really not right with God. If we have people who are not grounded in the basics of the Christian life. And he's found that as he's gone in and taught follow-up, in the process of teaching evangelism, people experience spiritual renewal, and all of a sudden evangelism starts taking place in the process of teaching them how to follow up others. All of a sudden it clicked. The dynamic is there. We must impart the spiritual basics and not overlook it, or the building of a team will be for naught. And the idea is we must seek to ground these men in time in the Word, in time in prayer, in personal witnessing, what it means to walk in the Spirit, how to get up after you fall down. We must meet them where they are and talk with them the basics about the Christian life, imparting to them the basics of the Christian life. Number two, imparting vision to them. Imparting vision to them. Crucial, I believe, to share with these men that they are a part of something larger than themselves. They are a part of the plan of the ages. They are, corny as it may sound, yet Pauline, they are good soldiers of Jesus Christ in the Great Commission Army. And the Great Commission is that which is center stage in human history. And what they are involved in is that which is going to count for all eternity. IBM cannot offer that to these men. The next dynamic, demonstration. He showed them how to live. He showed them how to live. One of the reasons that Jesus had such an impact on his team of men is because, like no one else, of course, being the God-man, he practiced what he preached. And it made a powerful impact on their lives. It's one of the reasons they kept on keeping on with him and developing as a team, is because he lived what he preached. And it's a powerful truth, a powerful principle that is here, the dynamic of demonstration. I would go as far as to say that your personal walk with God is probably one of the most important elements in building a team of Christian leaders. Peter puts it this way in 1 Peter 5, lead your flock by example. Shepherd them by example. Each week, talk about being put on the line. Each week, each of the men, in this last discipleship group, we had 11 men. Each of these 11 men, every Monday night, they know about their pastor. Number one, how were his devotional times this last week? I mean, we're talking every day. We're talking detail here. What about the pastor's memory work? What about the pastor's witness for Christ in the executive suite where he is? I mean, he's in a pit. How did he do this week? He's right where we live. And then on and on. And, you know, what about the Word? What did God show our pastor in the Word this week? It's kind of like every week they're tuned in to my life behind the scenes. The whole concept of demonstration. He showed them how to live. Without that, and without our own personal walk and renewal in our own personal walk, developing a team will just fall apart if they see that the reality is not in our own lives. F, delegation. Delegation. He assigned them work. Jesus developed his team by delegating major ministry responsibilities to them. This is a very important dynamic. And following Christ's example, we must never forget the power of involvement. I look back on my own spiritual pilgrimage, and it wasn't until a time when someone came to me, I was kind of just flopping along as a Christian in the Christian life, and someone came to me, and they challenged me with a ministry responsibility. And they delegated a responsibility, and they gave me authority with that responsibility to carry out that task. And I can tell you, I look back to that time in my life as the key time where there were major spiritual changes and renewal in my walk. And we must not forget the power of involvement. I was walking through our high school where the church meets. I was walking through the hallway and I saw a sign. It caught my eye this last week, and so I quickly whipped out the old daytimer and wrote it down. And it said, ancient Chinese proverb says, and it goes like this, tell me and I forget. Show me and I remember. Involve me and I understand. There is a power in involvement and in delegation. At Trinity, each man in the group, as a requirement to be in the discipleship group, must take a major area of responsibility. And I give each man with that responsibility, this is a key dynamic, authority. Never give responsibility without authority, or you'll leave your men high and dry. And the idea here is each man, to be a part of the group, as we'll see in a moment, must assume a spiritual ministry oversight or a responsibility. One man is in charge of evangelism. Another in Sunday school. Another one's in charge of setup and takedown. Another in charge of fellowship group. Another in charge of finances. And I mean, they are really in charge. It's not like I let them dabble in it a little bit. I mean, they've got it. And periodically, I check in with them. We'll talk about that on the idea of supervision. But these delegated responsibilities play a major role in the development of these men, individually and in the group as a whole. I tell you, it's almost like, I was discussing with a man yesterday, it's almost like the real effect when you delegate ministry to these men is not so much their actual frontline ministry, but it's the effect in their lives as they are given delegated responsibility and authority. I mean, the real effect, yes, they carry out, but yes, the Sunday school, yes, the evangelism is going on, yes, these things are happening, but one of the most beautiful things are what is actually happening in the lives of these men who are being developed in the process of having had delegated responsibility and authority. Coming to the end, supervision, he kept check on them, supervision. You know, Jesus made it a point, if you stop and think through the Gospels, to get with his men following the ministry tours, remember? He'd get with them, he'd gather them all together, and he'd hear the reports. Okay, men, what happened? And then he'd listen to what they would say, and then he would instruct them as kind of a way of life coming right off the field. You know, this shows us that proper follow-up is crucial in developing a team. Without proper supervision, the job will often not be done. A church planter's proverb ought to be, many a man, as it is in the Proverbs, many a man proclaims his loyalty, but who can find a faithful man? Once a ministry responsibility has been given, and oh, I learned this the hard way, even this last year, fell flat on my face in this area. Once a ministry responsibility is delegated and given to one of these men, we must then learn to what I call supervise the process. And, you know, we can take this step of delegation. We can say, here it is, here are your gifts, here's the mix, go with it. And it's kind of like it's supposed to be finished on this certain date. Check back with me on the date the job's supposed to be over. And what happens is, if you don't check in from the time of delegation to the time the job's to be completed, and my philosophy was, okay, now the job's to be completed, come report to me. Was it all done okay? And almost every time, it was either not done at all or just done a little bit. I tell you, the bottom line is, it was as much a reflection upon my leadership as it was on that man's faithfulness. We must learn to come in the midst of that process and help him and motivate him and encourage him and teach him how to meet that end. That is a crucial concept in developing a team, that without it, we'll be delegating all kinds of responsibilities and nothing will ever get done. It just becomes a frustration pool. And it's not. And then we want to kick back and say, the faithless people, they're so unfaithful around here. And the bottom line is, often, is that we are not the kind of leaders we need to be. We're not delegating and then supervising. Okay? Final dynamic, reproduction. He expected them to reproduce. Jesus fully expected his men to reproduce their lives and the lives of others and thereby multiply the ministry of the gospel. In building a team, this means that we must follow Christ's example and always stress the importance of a ministry of multiplication. Two words that I use constantly, over and over again, back in Dallas, are transferability and reproduction. From the very time we landed, I've been using concepts of transferability and reproduction, always stressing it. In fact, when I landed on the field, I set up the church planting file. Anything that I learned by default, by falling on my face or whatever, I was going to take it, put it in a file so that I could put it in a palatable form and give it to other church planters so that they could not have to fall on their face. I came to this conference with between 3,000 and 5,000 pages of lecture notes. The printing company had to dolly them to me. And it's the idea, it's a commitment to transferability and to reproduction. Now, even before I left, the man who's in charge of setup and takedown crew, this man met with me, and you've never seen such a beautiful job description. I mean, PC, justified margins, slick. And what he was doing is, this is the second or third revision on the setup and takedown crew job description list. And the reason why it was being done so beautifully, he knew that we were going to take that, and in our vision for multiplying other churches and planting other churches and helping other churches to grow, we were going to give that as a model and put it in the manual that we're developing to give to on-hand help to church planters. And so what's he doing? Man, he's flicking this thing up. It's perfect. It's shaped. It's got its justified margin. Same thing with the evangelism ministry. The guy is doing that same thing. Why? The vision of multiplication, the vision of reproduction has been caught in these men. Not only in the ministry, but even, I think, of most importance, I openly share with the men my hope to see several of these men who are in the group now, 11 now, leading similar discipleship groups, which will in turn build a ministry of multiplication that will continue once I have passed from the scene. They all know that the pastor is seeking to work himself out of a job. And in the leadership, one of my survival tactics is Leadership Magazine, as I know it is with many of you. And there's that one leadership cartoon that they thoroughly enjoyed, and so did I, where all the laymen are coming up and they're shaking hands with the pastor and saying, "Great pastor, we don't need you anymore. Your lay renewal program has worked." And the pastor just, "Aw." It's the idea that we're really working ourselves out of a job with a vision that when we pass from the scene, these men have a vision for reproducing these same groups that have been modeled before them and carrying out this process. Now, the brief time we have left, I want to get very practical, very kind of hands-on practical. This final section, section 3, is what we're entitling the process of developing a team. Here I want to share with you some of the nuts and bolts of how we at Trinity are trying to actually implement these dynamics. Now, again, I say to you, this is just how we are doing it. I don't believe this is the way to do it. Everything is constantly in transition and changing and developing, but here is how we are seeking to implement these principles where we are. And if it's any encouragement to you or the development of your strategy, then it's fulfilled its purpose. We have three levels of training: basic training, intermediate training, and advanced training, taking someone all the way from the beginning stages of a new Christian up through the discipleship course, up into officer training. And it's kind of a three-tiered training program, basic training. We'll have to look at this real quickly. What we call the inquirer's class. This is a membership class, open to everyone in the church. And see, what's happened is the inquirer's class at Trinity, sneaky, it's really a basic discipleship course at the same time. It is to introduce people to some of the distinctives of our church, but its primary purpose is to lay a groundwork of basic discipleship, some of the basics of the Christian life. Let's go through this quickly. Now, when I began, I'll talk about this in the case study on Thursday. This is an ad for that one. But when I began, we went through these concepts that are set forth here in Numbers 1 through 6. We went through those in three quarters in great detail with the core group. Now these are being put in capsule form of 12 lectures to be continually taught during the Sunday school hour by me. And so somebody can come in at class 4 and just go through and pick up 1 through 3 next time, that kind of an idea. And so we'll talk about more of that in the case study on Thursday. But the idea here is introduction, we talk about our message, the gospel, our vision. Right there we share with them the vision, the philosophy of ministry of Trinity. Our commitment to worship, we ground them in personal worship. The dynamics of family worship, give them tools to help them begin family worship. And in corporate worship, where have average members been trained in corporate worship or any of the dynamics that are there? It's usually get the preliminaries over, let's get to the word. And it's a sad state of affairs. Our commitment to learning, we introduce the Westminster Standards there and highlight what you see in A through F, in inerrancy, covenant theology, doctrines of grace, distinctives of baptism, and the Lord's Supper. Our commitment to fellowship, there we talk about biblical church government, the idea of elders and deacons, biblical church discipline, one entire section on that, and the importance of it and what it means. Celebration, congregation, and cell, the fellowship structure of the church. And then our commitment to ministry, the master's plan. This is just another fancy way of talking about plan A and plan B. Sharing with the people, everyone who's about to join the church is challenged with the vision or the philosophy of plan A and plan B. And we want to be a plan A church if we're going to really accomplish that which God has set before us. Spiritual gifts, we get into everything, charismatic movement and all the rest, we go ahead and talk it through. Biblical giving, tithing, are we not under the law? Especially in my country, Dallas Seminary country, these are issues, especially infant baptism, Calvinism, tithing. I mean, these are issues in Dallas that are maybe more pressing than other areas of the country. And so what I've done is I know probably hundreds of hours I put into developing these crazy lectures for the inquirer's classes and for officer training. And so if I could just spare anyone from having to labor over any of these, I brought them and had the secretary reproduce them, and I've got them set up back there, lectures on all of these topics. The only one that hasn't been put together is the Lord's Supper. the Lord's Supper, but all these other topics are there in lecture form. And we want to make those available to you for the cost of how much it is to copy them and mail them to you. If there are just a few who want them, I've taken about 4 sets here. And so I want to give away all that we've got, and if there are any more, we want to mail them to you just for what it costs us to copy them and mail them. So those are all on the back table back there, and you can look at those and sign the sheet if you want. Don't take any now. Sign the sheet, and then if we just have a few people, I'll distribute those during the conference and get those to you. Okay? Intermediate training, let's wrap this up, the men's discipleship group, 12 to 16 weeks. Here we have those. Now, see, the idea is that basic training is everyone has had the basic training in the inquirer's class. Then the discipleship training is what we call intermediate. An open letter, here's where the methodology changes purposefully, point A. An open letter is sent to all the men in the church who have taken or are taking the inquirer's class. We'll look at that in just a second in the appendix. A letter goes out to all the men in the church who have taken the inquirer's class or are taking it. A special note is written to those who have been nominated as potential officers, we see on the next page. And a detailed commitment sheet is sent with each letter. Go to the appendix now, and you'll see the actual letter and the appendix and the commitment sheet that we send out to each man. Look at the letter first. If you look at the second or third sentence, any man at Trinity who is presently able to make this commitment is invited to be a part of the group. Note what I've done here, the way I have really blundered in the past that I've corrected by this method. And that is, the commitment level qualifies or disqualifies a man for the group, not the pastor. It's not this holy censor selection ability that God has given me of who are the men. And at the initial stages, that's key. That's important. But at this point, the commitment level makes the decision. And if a man is not willing to make that commitment, all I can say to him is, I'm really sorry. I hope there'll be a time where you'll be available and freed up to make this commitment. Pastor's no longer the bad guy, you see. It's the commitment that qualifies or disqualifies. And so on the next page, you see the spelled out group commitment. We won't go through this. But they're in the areas of personal piety, sound theology, effective ministry, and commitment to accountability in the above 3 areas. There's things like minimum time in the Word and prayer daily, recording insights, Bible memory, just some basic things that we're saying, if you want to be a part of this, this is the cost. This is the cost, and if you're serious about being a part of this group, here is the commitment. We lay it all out from the very beginning. Okay? But back to the page where we were, and point D, then a specific time is set as a deadline for a response for those interested in being in the next group. So this letter is sent out to the whole group, and I say, I want to hear from any of you that want to be a part of it by this date. Now, the ideal size of the group is 8 to 12. I don't know what we'd do if we got more. We haven't yet. And when they respond, I ask each man to write out his answers to the following questions and turn them in at the group meeting, listed in subpoints 1 through 5. This has been extremely helpful, and I just found this out about the second or third go-around in working with this discipleship group, to ask these questions, to have a file on each man. What is your reading plan, your Bible reading plan? What passages of Scripture are you planning to memorize? What are the names of at least 3 people in your network of relationships that you're going to be praying for to seek to reach them for Christ? What do you perceive to be your spiritual gifts and talents, whether they do or not, whether they understand what they might be or not? It's good to know that. And then finally, this is key, what are your greatest needs at the present time, and list any specific areas where you would like to see spiritual growth and development? A key idea is kind of like, tune me in. This is a personal note from you to me. Tune me in with what you'd like to see happen in your life over these next 12 to 16 weeks as we meet together. So as your pastor, I can be tuned in to what your needs are so I can pray for you. It's kind of that first opportunity to really get tuned in to the particular needs of the men. Training objectives of the group are threefold. I had to have some kind of, can you follow me here, Mr. Cameraman? I had to have some kind of an overhead. You can't. But the idea of balanced development, I had to bring my balanced development man. But the idea is one of the most serious problems, as ridiculous as this looks, in the training of men in discipleship groups is this kind of a result. In most training in churches, it is usually what? It's usually theology. It's usually, oh, you want to be trained to be a leader in this church? Let's learn Reformed doctrine. Let's go through 85 weeks in Reformed theology. And what happens is, this is what comes out often, is somebody who has not had a balanced training and a balanced development. And so what we're seeking to do, what, oh, did you get that? Okay. What we're seeking to do is to have balanced development. And so I've broken it down into three areas that can be easily remembered: personal piety, sound theology, and practical ministry, never emphasizing one over the other.